There is a door between the real and the unreal, at which daily we are knocking.
HPPodcraft.com.
My name is Lincoln Osgood. My age, 30. My nationality, American. My means, well, such as never to cause me a moment's anxiety or the negation of any fad. My hobbies have always been travel and science, the latter more particularly in its human than in its mechanical aspects. I am not, if I may say so, in any way the Yankee millionaire of popular fiction or even of fact. I both write and talk the King's English, I trust. And to tell the truth, I was educated up at Christ Church, Oxford, which is my first link with these extraordinary incidents, which it has now fallen to my lot to chronicle.
That is the first paragraph from The Door of the Unreal by Gerald Biss. It is a novel about the rare but excruciatingly dramatic condition of being a werewolf, and it has come by H.P. Lovecraft's recommendation to save us here at the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
And we are at HPPodcraft.com. I'm Chris Lackey.
And I am Chad Pfeiffer.
And folks, it's Werewolf History Month again.
Werewolf History Month is sort of the slam dance to Black History Month Sundance. I don't want anybody to get the idea that we're trying to replace Black History
Month. Oh, no.
No. I wish that we could actually do Black History Month on the show.
Yeah.
But obviously, H.P. Lovecraft doesn't include any of that in his list. And I don't think that there is any literature that we could really look at from that period.
I'd be curious if there's any non-white horror writers from the 19th century. I'm really curious if that work even exists.
That's one of the reasons. I mean, we're going to keep going with the theme for the time being of weird literature that influenced H.P. Lovecraft from his essay.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we've done as many post-Lovecraft shows now.
Have we?
As we did the original run, yeah. We're at 244, I think this is. So,
yeah, this is the 244th episode.
You know, we did 120 originally, so we are getting long in the tooth with this to an extent.
Wow.
But at some point, we might want to pivot, and that'll be nice, because then we actually can look at some African-American literature. I do want to thank our reader for this month, however.
Yes, Anthony Tedesco, a filthy, filthy man.
But a great, sumptuous voice.
He is. No, he's a wonderful reader, just a dirty, dirty guy.
He's a dirty guy, but I am glad to have him back.
His hygiene is good. He's just a filthy mind, and a delightfully filthy mind at that. You know, it was hard to find out information on Gerald.
On Gerald Biss, I know, yeah. And in fact, everybody I mentioned this book to had no idea what I was talking about. This isn't something that I think most people have heard of, The Door of the Unreal.
No, no. There's no Wikipedia entry on him at all, which is surprising to me. But I did find a website called Bear Alley Books that had a bio on him. And it doesn't cite any sources, so I have no idea how true this stuff is. But it sounded pretty confident.
Yeah.
His full name was Edwin Gerald Jones Biss, and he was born in Cambridge in 1876, so he was English.
Yes.
Fourth son of a physician who was the pioneer of open-air treatment of consumption. He went to school in Cambridge, graduated in 1895, was going to take the bar, but decided he was going to become a journalist instead and found himself writing for newspapers. Specifically, he found kind of a niche in writing about the new sport of motoring.
He was a writer about cars, and that comes screaming out of this novel constantly.
Yes.
If a car shows up, he's going to take some time to describe the make, the model, possibly the top speed.
Yep.
It's almost like a fetish for him. So I was glad, because I read through the same bio, I was glad to know that before I dove in. Otherwise, I would have, you know, it just made it amusing. It's like Angora to Ed Wood for this guy. He needs to talk about his car.
I started reading it before I read this bio. So to me, I'm going, wow, he talks about cars a lot. And at one point, he even says, I know I'm talking about cars a lot, but. And then I read this and I go, oh, okay, that now it all makes sense.
But it is kind of cool because it's the dawn of the automobile when he is talking about them. This,
yeah.
This book came out in 1919. Cars have been around for almost 20 years at that point, but still on a commercial level, it was something that only wealthy people had.
Yeah.
It's interesting to hear him talk about them.
He was also really into criminology. He studied the subject thoroughly scientifically from both medical and legal point of view, attributing his success largely to the fact that he can never play the fool with his public. And it shows in this story. He sticks to the facts, and it's almost written like it's a report.
Yes, definitely. He says he aims at making all of his plots, however unusual, appear credible.
Right.
And so he just does a lot of research.
Yeah.
And I think has the point of view that Lovecraft had as well, which is establish some sort of verisimilitude or realism so that when the odd things happen, they feel like they can really be happening.
Right.
The Door of the Unreal is his best-known novel. As I said, it was out in 1919. It appeared long before Hollywood established the Wolfman legends or the things that we associate with werewolves, but a lot of them are definitely in this book. I do know that he used some other source material. There was one book that he drew on heavily for this. We can talk about it later because he actually cites it at the end of the novel. H.P. Lovecraft in Supernatural Horror and Literature said that this novel quite dexterously handles the standard werewolf superstition. That's why we're reading it.
And because it's Werewolf History Month.
That's right.
He was also physically a large man. He was very heavy set. He died at age 46, so pretty young, a heart attack. And that was in 1922.
That's another thing that stands out in his writing. Although, you know, obviously most things in the very upper crust cast of characters that we have in this story, a lot of things revolve around them eating.
Yeah.
But he never stops. He always describes it when the characters eat in this book.
He does.
He always says they are very hungry. They needed to get lunch. They ate with huge appetites, and it was all delicious. I mean, even if somebody has a snack, he pauses to reflect upon the snack before he moves on with the narrative.
This story is, just to warn folks, it's pretty pulpy.
This isn't the kind of thing where you're going to take away incredible examples of fiction writing.
No.
It's definitely more like a movie. It's very story-driven. It's a pulp, but that's a great relief. I mean, I read it like candy. It was great.
It's a super easy, fun read. And it's ridiculous at points, but I laughed and just kept reading.
Yeah, it was fun. I had a blast. And it's in three parts, and I think you can take each one of them down in 1 hour or 2 reading sessions. So
very
digestible. So let's kick it off.
We start off with the narrator describing himself, and that's what Anthony just told us at the beginning. This guy, his name is Lincoln Osgood. He's 30 years old, a man with some wealth who's an American and a world traveler.
I found it amusing that he was saying, I'm not what you'd usually think of as a Yankee millionaire. But then he pretty much is a Yankee millionaire.
Yeah,
I mean, he's a rich guy. Yeah. I think, though, that there in drama often was that sort of, I'm a Texan who's here to solve these English dramas. And he's, you know, in the foreword to the edition of this that I read, the PDF that's available online, it's the 1920 American edition. He hits on it again in that foreword that he's happy to write a non-stereotypical American because he's met so many kind-hearted Americans that he liked a lot when he was being educated. And I think it also says a lot about the context of this book. It came out in 1919, just 2 years after the Great War had ended.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously in that conflict, we had the British and the Americans allying against a German foe.
Right.
And here we have it again in miniature in this novel. The werewolf is an invading force that the Americans and the British have to band together to defeat. And I think that you can definitely read this whole text. You have to keep that context firmly in mind.
Right.
If things seem a little black and white.
Yeah.
Also in his foreword, Biss noted that in his research, he did a lot of research for this, again, coming across legends that he says are existent in North America as well. And we've definitely covered all that stuff Werewolf History Month previously. But he ends that foreword with a note saying, you know, the war has taught us that nothing is too ghoulish to be true. And I'm not as much a skeptic as I once was. So maybe he thinks werewolves are real. The other thing I wanted to note, and I thought maybe this would have...
I don't think that's what he's trying to say.
I do. I think that's what he's trying to say. Something about that opening, there is a door between the real and the unreal at which daily we are knocking, was knocking in my brain at some other text that we had covered before. And it's actually the first story we ever covered.
The Tomb.
Lovecraft writes, men of broader intellect know that there is no sharp distinction betwixt the real and the unreal, that all things appear as they do only by virtue of the delicate individual physical and mental media through which we are made conscious of them, i.e. a door of some kind. So this idea of a door between the real and the unreal, although Lovecraft wrote that in 1917, he obviously hadn't read this book yet, but interesting that they're both hitting on that same expression of how the supernatural comes through into our world. So anyway, we have Lincoln Osgood, the American.
He brings up his best bud, Burgess Climping, who was a fella that he met when he went to school in Oxford, another rich guy, but more of a homebody. He doesn't travel much. He just stays on his estate.
Yeah, he owns a nice property in Sussex. The whole novel is set in what is often described as sleepy, commonplace Sussex, a place you wouldn't expect a supernatural occurrence to happen.
Now, Lincoln tells us he's no storyteller. He's just reporting the facts. He's a chronicler. In fact, the whole first part of this book is just separate pieces of evidence.
You will find that almost the entire book plays like a role-playing game. It's kind of amazing. This first part, it's as if you've been handed newspaper clippings to kind of catch you up on the mystery. They assemble, I'm not spoiling anything, but a gang of guys get together to take on this. And they freaking make maps and they put down what their positions are going to be, where right. they're going to go in. All of this stuff happens in the story. So if you've ever played a role-playing game and enjoyed that process, you're basically right. reading a novelization.
Especially a role-playing game like Call of Cthulhu.
Especially, yeah. It's just like that, right down the line.
So the first newspaper article is from the Sussex Daily Times. The title of the article is The Mystery of the Brighton Road. I'll sum it up really quick for you. A newlywed couple's car is found on Brighton Road going between Brighton and London. Mr. and Mrs. Bolsover left from a friend's house, and they were on their way back to London. They never made it back. The car was found empty on the side of the road. People thought it was maybe abandoned, but there was blood found on the seat. So then they thought, okay, foul play. But it goes on to a lot of detail about the make of the car.
Obviously,
in this article.
Yeah.
I don't know why that's important. Also, her shawl was found on the ground outside of the vehicle, and it was a full moon.
Full moon when that happened. I think they found some strange scratches on the car as well.
Yeah, that's right. But no bodies, nothing. That's all that was found. Doc 2 is a memorandum that Lincoln wrote, and it just basically fills in the gaps and says the mystery had a lot of people talking, lots of speculation about the missing couple, but still no evidence.
And they were such a commonplace, boring couple. The fact that something this extraordinary happened to them is yeah. one of the reasons that it's so sensational.
So Doc 3 is from this thing called Town Tit Bits.
Yes.
Which I thought it would be tidbits, but I guess it's titbits, which seems to be kind of a tabloid that goes into a rumored relationship about two London stage celebrities, Miss Yvette Sinclair, a.k.a. Waffles, and Tony Bullingdon.
Tony is an earl of some kind. I think he owns a few huge properties. I wasn't sure if he owned the theater that she works at or not.
That's what I got, yes.
Well, he had some huge party there when he was having his coming out or coming of age or I'm eligible to marry somebody party.
Right.
It's somewhat scandalous, I think, that she and he are connected because she's just an actress and he's this earl or this potential mm-hmm. earl or I don't know. He's rich. I found that amusing that that's the scandal because, you know, now it's the invert. There were a lot of these funny joke headlines when Clooney got married recently.
Right.
It was, you know, because his wife is it was like world famous human rights lawyer marries actor, you know?
Right.
And that was the joke headline.
Yeah.
But this actually would be, you know, this earl is going to marry this cheap stage actress. So the scandal would be that. You know?
Yeah.
The celebrities didn't quite have the status they do now.
So the fourth document that's presented is a statement from William Wellingham. He was a friend of Tony's. We get most of what happened from him, from his account.
In that document, we know he's describing something that's happened. He just offhandedly says, Tony is okay, but poor Waffles has gone. So we know something tragic happened to this couple.
Bill and some friends, including Tony and Waffles, were in Brighton, and they're coming back to London on a full moon, lit night.
Same stretch of road.
Tony and Waffles were in a sports car, and Bill and another guy and two ladies were in his car.
Which are described, make, model, all that business.
In great detail. They left first, but Tony and Waffles pass by them because his car is a sports car, so it goes yeah. much faster.
In fact, they have to slow down when he passes by just because the wake of it, right. all of the dust that it kicks up, makes it uncomfortable driving for them. So, yeah, so they had to slow down because he's just kicking dirt up into your face.
But a bit later, they see something off the side of the road. It's a burning car. It had gone through these hedges and was off sort of in the side on this field. They realize that it's Tony's car. Girls start freaking out and the guys run to see what's going on. They get there soon enough that the fire has just started and they can see that there's no bodies inside of it.
Yeah, in fact, they find Tony's cap a few feet away, which would make them think that maybe the people got thrown from the car and then it caught on fire.
Right.
But they can't find them.
So the guys start looking around. The girls are in the car freaking out. Another car arrives and it's this guy, Fitzroy Manders.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome names in the story.
Yeah.
Manders, he's a lawyer, and he's got this other guy with him. Manders takes charge of the situation because Bill and Harry are kind of, that's the name of his buddy, Harry are kind of freaked out.
Right, and Manders has got the kind of attitude that lets you know he is in charge. So even though he doesn't know these people, he shows up and they sort things out pretty quickly.
Yeah, my friend will take these ladies up to the inn, which is just down the road a ways. They'll call the authorities. I'll stay here and we'll help you try and find the bodies. And the guys are like, okay, yeah, whatever. So they look around, nothing. Police show up, they find nothing. Mystery number two.
Right, so now we've got this stretch of road where, on two full moon nights, people have disappeared in their cars.
Now we're back to Lincoln, tying things together. This thing was big before the celebrities got involved in it. Now that there are celebrities and an earl, it's like off the hook. You know, it's just, it's in all the papers. The investigation becomes one of the biggest ever. It's not just the local police. Scotland Yard gets in on it. Mm-hmm. It's really cold out. The ground is frozen, so it's hard to track things. They try to bring bloodhounds in, but by the time they do, there's been so many other people trotting around that they don't really help them find anything. Some people are trying to say that the bodies were just burned up in the car, but Bill's testimony says, no, they weren't, because I was there and there were no bodies in the car.
It's funny because Lincoln writes, no one familiar with the history of the disposal of bodies by burning and the interesting cases on the subject gave it a moment's serious consideration. Who's he talking about? Aside from him, like...
I don't know.
Because you're surely familiar with the disposal of bodies by burning, like as if that's something people just know about.
No, they don't.
But they also know that nobody could have kidnapped these people because there have been no ransom demands of any.
We're going to shift narrative over to his buddy Burgess, who's been around and he knows what's going on. The thing about Burgess is that he lives right next to where all this stuff is happening. He lives like 3 miles away from where these incidents happen.
Exactly. So when Lincoln shows up, we know that Lincoln's going to bring in some kind of piece of evidence or information that's going to change this whole book. But we don't know what it is at this point.
Right.
He just shifts over and says, this is Burgess's account of what happened.
We find out that, well, Burgess downplays his wealth. He says, I'm not really that rich. We had a lot of money, but we don't have much money anymore. I just live here with my younger sister. She takes care of, you know, the house and the cooking and things. I'm not married. I don't really need to be married because I got my sister that takes care of me and stuff like that. But it's really funny because through the course of this, you find out that he's got like a butler and there's this other guy that works there. And then there's this housekeeper as well that's there. Like there's the whole staff involved, but he really downplays his wealth.
Yeah. Well, he's not rich like Bullingdon, but he lives a very comfortable life.
And now he goes into a little strange, the description of his sister, and describes her being very pretty, and it's slightly creepy.
I know, I don't think it's meant to be that way, but it sure comes off that way.
She's
tall, active, and wonderfully fair, a rare thing in these days, with remarkable gray eyes, with long black lashes, an arched black brow, and a magnificent lithe figure. I could write lots about Anne's beauty and good points as a pal, but this is hardly the place to let myself go.
Yuck!
Yeah, that's gross. I felt a little gross reading it. Now, the house that they live in is Climping Manor. This is the family house, and it's been in his family in unbroken succession since the 14th century, which is another reason he'll need to marry and stop hanging out with his sister so much, because he's got to get out of this House of Usher situation. You know, he's got to keep the family line going. And now the most amazing part of the entire book happens.
Yeah, this is it. So there's another section of the estate called Dower House.
Right, and that is the house that used to be the family home.
Right.
But obviously it's in a really dusky, moist part of the woods, basically.
Yeah.
And at some point, one of the Climpings said, this is ridiculous. Let's build a house out in the sunshine. So we have that, you know, the dower house is in the dark, mysterious part of the estate.
Right.
And the house where the heroes live is in the sunny, bright one.
You know, they had some help living there at one point, but then they're like, you know, we should really rent this place out. So, oh gosh, they find somebody that has some really good credentials that will rent it out. And he's a German scientist.
Yes.
And his name is, and I kid you not, Lycurgus Wolf.
I laughed out loud when that happened. Professor Lycurgus Wolf. Come on.
Yeah. That was pretty surprising. So
that's like if Dracula had been like, good evening. My name is Count Bloodrink M. Vampire. Of course, that is vampire with two R's. Do not get any ideas. It's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. I don't know. It kind of set the tone for the story for me.
Well, once that happened, I was like, this is going to be great. I was so happy. Because I thought maybe it would be, oh, we'd hint forever at what was happening. And it'd be, you know, typical, like what we read normally. But as soon as that was his name when he showed up, I was like, there's going to be werewolf action in here. I mean,
yeah.
No doubt about it.
Yeah.
This is pulp.
Exactly.
He was a very striking-looking man of 60, with shaggy gray hair and beard, a pair of remarkably piercing black eyes under long, straight, slanting brows which met in a point over his nose, and distinctly pointed ears set low and far back on his head, half hidden by his long hair. His mouth, under his straggling, unkempt mustache, was full and red-lipped, and he had a very fine set of even white teeth, especially considering his age. His hands were long and pointed, projecting curiously far at the third finger, and noticeably hairy, with red almond-shaped curving nails. He was tall and rather lean, with a slight stoop, and walked with a peculiar long, swinging stride. Altogether, a strange and rather bizarre personality in the surroundings of sleepy Sussex, especially as in winter he always wore a Russian cap of gray fur and a heavy gray fur coat.
Boom.
It's like they couldn't make him any more wolf-like. There's no way, unless he was actually a wolf. It's just not, it's not possible. There's nothing more they could have done. He goes on to say that this guy is very good company, well-educated, but a little creepy. And it's not just the professor that's there. He lives there with his daughter as well, Dorothy, and this middle-aged woman, Anna, not to be confused with Anne, who's his sister. Anna, who was a servant, probably Dorothy's nanny before, but now she's just kind of the family servant. But she's really creepy and weird.
She wears the fur, too, and it says she's a rather sinister person with gray, glinting eyes. She's that wolf hag.
Yeah, exactly. And, of course, Dorothy is super foxy.
Mm-hmm. And it says, pointedly in the text, she is without the least trace of the Teutonic type. She doesn't look German. She doesn't look like her dad at all.
She's 22, small and dainty, very attractive. She dresses very conservatively, but you can see underneath she's a sexy librarian. You know,
totally,
she's got it going on.
Yeah.
Anna watches over her with an iron eye.
With an eye.
I don't know. But yeah.
With an iron eye. That's the expression.
She's watched over like a hawk, so she can't get out to any shenanigans. Now, Anne and Dorothy become fast friends. And Dorothy would hang out over at their place a lot because Anne found Anna really creepy and basically the whole place. Strangely, the professor's work is a study of entomology, which is the study of insects.
Yeah.
Which I didn't expect. I thought it would be, you know, the study of wolves or something to that effect. But no.
I know. That's the one place they dropped the ball. He really should be studying pack mentality.
So realizing he's off point, goes back to telling his story.
Burgess, you mean? Yes. He gives all this detail and then he starts telling the story.
So he wakes up that morning that there was an accident. His servant, this is when you find out he's got a butler, wakes him up and says, oh, there's been an accident. So he rushes off with his other servant, Hedges, who drives him out. And he puts on his little hunting suit because, oh yes, Burgess is a very good hunter. That's a little fact that probably will come into play later. He gets down the scene. It's rainy. The police are all over. He recognizes the chief inspector, this guy Mutton, talks to him. He tells him the story as we know it so far. And he introduces Manders as well as Bill and Harry. Now, Bill and Harry look like they're wrecks because they've been up all night. It's raining. So he goes, hey, why don't you guys come back to my place? We'll get you some food, give you a hot bath, help you out. They agree. So Anne takes the guys in, feeds them up. They're all rested, feeling good. They go back to the scene, and now it's a circus. All the paparazzi are there and taking pictures, and everybody wants to know what's going on. And Major Blenkinsop from Scotland Yard is there, which is, I always wondered what Scotland Yard was because I never really understood. Is it like the English FBI or what is it? And it's not. It's just London's police department.
Yeah.
So the whole metropolitan area, which is a very big area, is what is called Scotland Yard. And Scotland Yard isn't even really at Scotland Yard anymore. It got moved. The guys find out that there's nothing new. They haven't uncovered any evidence, found anything. So the boys decide to head back to London. Later on, he gets a telegram saying that Lincoln is coming back to England and was going to pay them a visit.
In all that time, there's no meal that is not mentioned, by the way.
Right. So the next morning, he's back at the scene. Mutton was there with a ton of cops. Still nothing new. He goes back, takes his sister and his dog, Whiskers, out on a walk.
She wants to go hang out with Dorothy, but while they're taking care of all this business with the car, he doesn't like her walking down to the Dower House alone, so that's why they go down.
So they get near the Dower House. Whiskers senses something. So he runs over, he starts digging, and he digs and he digs and he digs, and he finds a body, and it's Tony. And you think, oh God, Tony's dead, there's his body, but guess what? He ain't dead.
He's not dead.
He's alive, but he's really roughed up. His coat's tore up. He looks like somebody who's been dragged or rough-handled, you know, and this is way far from the scene of the crime.
Yeah, this is like a mile and a half away.
So, of course, first aid, you want to get this guy some quick medical attention. Yeah. So get him some whiskey.
Absolutely, as quickly as you
can. That's what he needs is some whiskey. He takes a look at him. His shoulder seems really messed up. But other than that, he's okay. Right. He's unconscious, but he's still okay. Anne runs off to get help from the Dower House. Burgess runs off to get the police, leaving Whiskers to guard Tony, which seems crazy to me.
Great plan.
He finds a policeman, tells the policeman to go fetch Mutton, and then he goes back to where Tony is and finds his sister and the professor are there, Professor Wolf, tending to his wounds. Now, professor's cutting off pieces of Anne's petticoat and using them as bandages, which is very strange.
Like you have a full package of bandages right next to you, Professor Wolf. Shut up. Give me your blouse.
So the professor says he heard the dog barking, so he came to see what was going on. The dog doesn't like the professor, of course. Mm-hmm. They send Anne to go home and get a fire going and prep for Tony's treatment. The professor says he's got broken ribs as well, and the professor has some medical expertise. He notices that his driving jacket, Tony's driving jacket, is made of this really thick leather. It's lined leather, and that is what's protected him. So he actually isn't that wet from the elements.
Yes.
He would have probably died and bled out, but also his jacket protected him from the wound, and it also protected him from the elements. So again, really focused on this whole driving thing and how good
it's probably an ad next to it. Yeah, I'm sure.
So he fixes him up as best he can right there. Mutton and some men show up to tend to his wound. He had to cut off his clothes, and Mutton's really mad about that because it's evidence. And he's like, why did you tamper with the evidence? And Wolf just gets in his face and says, look, I'm here to save this man's life.
He says he shows his white teeth a little angrily when they question him about it.
Yeah.
But, you know, actually later Anne confirms it. She says that the clothing was all, you know, stuck to the wound. It had to be torn off. So it's plausible that he really did it for medical reasons, although it also, luckily, gets all the teeth marks out of it, right?
Right, exactly. So he takes it back to Burgess's place. The professor leaves in his fur coat again.
So they're back at Clifton Manor. They're going to keep Tony there. He's unconscious still. Anne suddenly takes on this role of head nurse. And throughout the book, they can't stop talking about what a good little nurse she is. It's like one would be tempted to disregard the era in which this was written for a moment and say, you know, women are treated like idiots in this book. But it goes so overboard, it's like you can't even get upset about it. You know what I mean? It's so ridiculous. Yeah. Anne always comes in when the men are, she's like, well, I guess I'll let you mend to your mending now, and I'm going to go off and nurse my patient and bother my head with silly little pretty things.
Well, when this happens, he realizes that he's totally forgotten to pick up Lincoln from the train station.
Yes, and so we transition back over to Lincoln. Shows up, notices that his buddy isn't there, so, you know, he says, I got to go to Climping Manor. He grabs a carriage. Of course, everybody thinks that he's Sherlock Holmes or something, showing up out of nowhere, headed out there. Lincoln settles in. He and Burgess get right down to the case. They talk it over and all the peculiarities. A bunch of doctors are going to show up to take care of Tony, and Major Blenkinsop is going to show up from Scotland Yard pretty soon. As they talk over the case with the major when he does show up, they bring up Fitzroy Manders. There's an interesting coincidence here. It turns out that Lincoln and he, quote, ran up against each other in Romania last year and knocked about together for a week. And Blenkinsop says, yeah, I know Manders. He's a really sweet criminologist. I trust the things that he says. So we've got a little bit of the...
Sweet.
That's the exact quote. That guy's a sweet criminologist. Dude. They get a doctor's report that says the one puzzling thing about Tony's condition is that he's got a wounded shoulder. The lacerations are really thick. Luckily, the driving coat saved him. But it's weird. Where did they come from? They speculate maybe a dog dragged him somewhere, which maybe is because they let Whiskers stay in charge of him, which is exactly what a dog would do. But no, they don't think that's probably what happened, but they're very confounded by it. You know, there are these long scenes of everybody sitting around talking formally. Anne and Lincoln finally see each other. They have a really weird relationship. They're always flirting, so I kind of thought that maybe there was a romantic thing going on with them under the surface.
Yeah,
but she describes him as kind of balding and getting old. So I don't know if it's a patronizing thing and that they have a
more brotherly, sisterly relationship.
Yeah, at this point, it's really tough to tell. So I have to say, I kind of got invested in these romantic relationships.
Yeah.
And another one gets introduced pretty soon. I'll get to that in a second. First, the wounds are healing up really fast for the patient. And he's still comatose, but after a couple of days, he goes into these deliriums. He cries out for Waffles, and then he says over and over again, big dog jumped over moon, green eyes, big dog jumped over moon, green eyes.
Yeah, probably not as coherent as that, but
yes,
probably more like big dog jumped over moon, green eyes.
That's pretty good. Okay, it probably sounded much more like that.
The professor and his daughter come calling, asking after the patient, and Lincoln notices that everything described about the professor is true. He's got white teeth. People are saying that he's creepy. You know, there's more talk about the professor and how creepy he is. Like, one thing that Anne says is he likes to lick his lips a lot. He's fascinated with him. He's repugnant, but he can't stop looking at him because he's so interesting.
This is completely the Van Helsing Dracula moment. The werewolf shows up and they size each other up, protagonist to antagonist.
Yeah.
The professor talks about his research and, you know, everything's going okay when, you know, Lincoln is talking to him about botany. And they hit it off because when he talks about his research, the professor can be very charming almost. He goes on and on about it. There are more references in this section to Dorothy not resembling her father. Also, Burgess, Lincoln notices, seems really interested in Dorothy, so perhaps he's finally found that match. Something about the professor is bothering Lincoln, though, especially associated with the recent disappearances, so he doesn't want to say anything about it yet, but he invites himself down to see the collections of insects that the professor has.
Right.
At his house. And of course, the professor just obviously doesn't want anybody to come down, but he's trying to keep up appearances. So he says, yes, of course, if you want to come down sometime, see my insects. After they leave, Lincoln turns around and says to Burgess, hey, I got to go into town and I need to talk to Manders. So I'm going to go jump on the train tomorrow and get out of here. And by the way, I'm not going to tell you shit about what I'm doing.
It's like, why do I want to tell him? And he goes, we've been friends for a long time, but I want to make sure before I tell you anything. You know, which of course is, I think this guy's a werewolf.
But Burgess wants to know, you know, are you coming back at least?
I will return, I answered, giving him my hand. Whatever happens, I promise you to see this through to the bitter end. And God knows when I spoke those words, by no means lightly. I never dreamt how bitter the end was destined to be.
Uh-oh.
Oh boy, trouble.
I think your suspicions may be confirmed, but we of course will not know. Until we go on to the second part of this book.
Yes.
In next week's episode.
Yeah, so that was in a part one. So next week, we're going to go into part two. I want to thank Anthony Tedesco for his wonderful reading, and he's going to be with us on this whole story.
I believe he is, and I think he's doing a great job so far. All I got to say is I really like this.
I'm thoroughly enjoying it. It's an really easy read. I know it's a little ridiculous with the guy being pretty obvious and all that jazz, but it's still fun.
Everything in entertainment these days is so nuanced. I like a good black and white story once in a while, especially these kind of monster things. I don't want to spoil anything for you, but I mean, you know, the bad guys are bad, the good guys are good.
And with that, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.